Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest reports from Liberia that suggest the Ebola epidemic is spreading exponentially and is largely out of control, with the World Health Organization warning Liberia faces a huge surge in Ebola. Steve Radelet, who is the Donald F. McHenry Chair of Global Human Development at Georgetown University, who was formerly Chief Economist of USAID and has served as Economic Advisor to Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf since 2005. He joins us to discuss the extent to which the health crisis in Liberia is exacerbated by a governance crisis and devastated infrastructure as legacies of a brutal and destructive civil war. Then we'll assess the chances of the just-announced new Iraqi government in Baghdad stepping up to combat the Islamic State and heal the rift with the alienated Sunni minority, who are unlikely to want to be liberated by the Shiite-dominated military that has oppressed and marginalized them. Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and the author of the new book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, joins us to discuss the exaggerated and almost hysterical fear of 10,000 Islamic State fighters and his article at the History News Network, Americans Are Worried About ISIS and Putin, What They Should Be Worried About is Climate Change. Then finally, Antonio Gonzalez joins us in the studio. He is the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the United States. We will discuss the growing disillusionment and fury in the Latino community expressed in Spanish language media against President Obama's decision to delay executive action on immigration reform out of concerns that vulnerable Senate Democrats facing re-election will be punished at the polls in November by an anti-immigrant backlash and charges of executive overreach. And joining us now is Steve Radelet, who is the Donald F. McHenry Chair of Global Human Development and a professor of the practice of development at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, formerly a senior advisor to Secretary of State Clinton and chief economist of USAID. He focuses on economic growth, poverty reduction, and foreign aid, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. He has served as economic advisor to Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf since 2005. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Radelet.
Thanks, Ian. I'm glad to be with you.
And the BBC is reporting that the Ebola crisis in Liberia is spreading exponentially, and that the World Health Organization has warned that Liberia faces a huge surge in Ebola. My understanding is that what's at issue here is a devastated country with a broken infrastructure and essentially broken governance. Is that at the heart of this spreading health crisis?
Well, we have a combination of an incredibly virulent disease that is manifesting itself in ways that we've never seen before. This is the first time that Ebola has ever been in an urban area where there's so many people, and therefore it can spread as quickly as possible. So one part of this is something way beyond the control of Liberians. Second, it is one of the poorest countries in the world with some of the weakest infrastructure and strains on governance. It is much better than it was 10 years ago at the end of the Civil War. There has been incredible progress since then, but they started with such a low base of professional capacity, of healthcare workers, of doctors, physicians, economists, engineers. Infrastructure was basically non-existent, that even after 10 years of recovery, it's still one of the poorest countries in the world. Just to give you two indications of how much the infrastructure was destroyed during the war, for 15 years there was no electricity at all in the country other than individual generators, because all electricity generation had been wiped out. And second, there was no piped water. All water had to come from wells, because all piped water had been blown up. So this was a country that was virtually destroyed by war, has made incredible progress since then, but is still very, very weak. And so when a disease like this hit so hard, they really just did not have the capacity to address the type of epidemic that, frankly, the world has never seen before.
But my understanding is that the epidemic is in a very crowded slum area of Monrovia, and that rather than provide government services, which are pretty much non-existent, the military went in and sort of basically said, you're all trapped in a slum where there's a virulent disease at loose among you and you can't move. And in fact, at one point, I believe the military opened fire on the very concerned and panicked civilians, killing a young boy.
Yeah, so there was the disease came over from Sierra Leone and first went into Liberia, into Monrovia, into the hospitals. A woman who was sick with the virus went to a hospital in Monrovia. Since no one there had ever dealt with the disease, they didn't recognize it, and soon doctors and nurses and others in the hospital were infected, and it spread from there throughout the city. One region, a slum area called West Point, there were infections there. They set up a center. It was actually a converted elementary school to receive patients, but the local citizens rioted and took over the facility and stole a lot of the medical supplies, and that's what spurred first the police and then the military to come in. And for a few days, they did put the area under quarantine, which is what some experts suggested. Other experts said they should not do that. But it was under quarantine for several days, and during the rioting, one 16-year-old was shot. But they have ended that quarantine now and are trying to get medical services to people, but it's absolutely overwhelming the small health system that they have.
So when we hear reports of the World Health Organization saying that Liberia faces a huge surge and that it's spreading exponentially, what's your understanding of where it stands? Because there's been so much hysteria expressed about Ebola, and I think you probably recall recently when a couple of infected medical workers returned to the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. A lot of ignorant speculation in this country coming from people like Donald Trump suggested these people should be left to die in Africa. Right. So without it even being a problem here in the United States, there's a level of hysteria. So one can imagine what's going on in Liberia.
Yeah, it is to a large extent, this becomes a disease of poverty. And because Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea are so poor, one of the dimensions of poverty is that they don't have the doctors, the nurses, the facilities, the protective equipment that can protect people. And so the disease is actually rather hard to spread. It requires bodily fluids, direct contact with bodily fluids. It is not airborne, and most people get sick either because they're medical professionals or because they're in contact with deceased members of their family, where they wash the bodies after death, and that spreads the disease. But in the United States and in Europe, we have much more advanced medical systems and public health systems, and we're in a much better position to, first of all, diagnose the disease and then quickly put people into isolation. We have the buildings, we have the facilities, we have the number of medical professionals to do that, whereas in poor countries, they don't have the doctors, they don't have the nurses, they don't have the gloves, they don't have the masks, and so it spreads very, very quickly. And it is spreading very fast because people are, once you're exposed and begin to show symptoms, for 21 days, you're at risk of spreading the disease. And so the only way that we know how to stop this thing is to track people for 21 days. In rich countries, we can do that. In poor countries, it's a lot harder to do it, and so it's spreading very quickly.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Radelet, who's the Donald F. McHenry Chair in Global Human Development and a Professor of the Practice of Development at Georgetown University and a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, formerly a Senior Advisor to Secretary of State Clinton and Chief Economist of USAID. He focuses on economic growth, poverty reduction, and foreign aid, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, and he has served as Economic Advisor to Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf since 2005. So, to understand this crisis, I think one has to understand the crisis in governance and the extent to which Liberia has been devastated by civil war. I vividly recall I guess you could refer to them as the old guard, since Liberia was in many ways founded by returning American slaves, and Marcus Garvey, etc. We all recall that history. But there was a kind of a political establishment there, and I recall them being lined up on the beach and being shot by Sergeant Doe. And it seems that since that incident, the country's kind of been circling the drain. And Charles Taylor, this horrible predatory criminal, devastated and looted the country with the help of people like Muammar Gaddafi, etc. Now, you know, you've got the president that you work for trying to put it back together again. So just walk us through that brief history, assuming I got it right, and how...
You've got it largely right. It's hard to summarize quickly, but it does start in the 1820s when freed American slaves who were sent back to West Africa. The early abolitionists were for freedom of the slaves, but they were not for integration, and so there was a push to move people back to Africa. Mostly they were mulatto. They were the children of white American men, slaveholders, and their black American slaves. They went back and basically set up a colony and over the indigenous people, and set up governance institutions that survived from the 1820s to independence in 1847, right up until 1980, where what are called the Americo-Liberians held political and economic power over indigenous populations. There was a lot of resentment. Samuel Doe came to power in 1980 in a bloody coup d'etat where he assassinated most of the cabinet, and that plunged the country into instability until 9 years later, when he himself was assassinated by a warlord named Prince Johnson, who was working with Charles Taylor at the time. That led to 15 years of complete chaotic war in Liberia and neighboring Sierra Leone, in Guinea and other countries. People will remember next door in Sierra Leone stories of people's arms and hands being chopped off, often by Charles Taylor's troops. The war ended, however, in 2003. Taylor went on trial at the International Court of Justice. He's been convicted of 11 counts of war crimes and will spend the rest of his life in jail. So that bloody, awful history ended in 2003. President Sirleaf was elected in 2005 and started her term in 2006. Since then, infant mortality and disease, infant mortality has fallen, disease has improved, incomes have doubled, poverty has fallen, but they started at such a low base that they're still very poor, very fragile, and while they're a democracy, they're a rather weak democracy in terms of all the institutions of law and governance and the free press that go with that. So they've made an incredible amount of progress, but this knocks them way back and is really devastating to a young democracy that has made so much progress rebuilding from that war.
And of course, obviously, this Ebola epidemic is the last thing the country needs. And so far, about 1,100 have died. What's your understanding about what kind of, given that we talked about, obviously, quarantines not working and the military not being the people that should be responding to a health crisis, where is the international community in this?
Well, the international community, frankly, failed to respond quickly when this became known back as early as March. The earliest case probably came into Guinea in December, but it was recognized in March, and there was a sense among the international actors that this thing would burn itself out, that they didn't have to really intervene, and so nobody really did until it really came out of control in July. And so groups like the WHO, the World Health Organization, that had the expertise didn't react as well as they should. So it really shows some weaknesses in how the world responds to disease. But at this point, in the last few weeks, finally the international community is ramped up. And what they're trying to do is build field hospitals. The Department of Defense, for example, is going to come in and help build some field hospitals, working with USAID and the State Department. Probably put in about, I think it's 500 beds in five field sites of 100 beds each. International NGOs like MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, has been great in setting up field hospitals. What they're trying to do is set up these tented field hospitals so that they can isolate people that have the virus and try to stop the contagion. But it is at such a level now that it will take a very big effort to try to isolate all these people and stop the disease. Unfortunately, we've never seen an outbreak like this. We're really in uncharted territory. And to be perfectly honest, the sad truth is that no one really knows how to stop an urban-based Ebola epidemic because we've never had one before.
And it does seem that health workers are you know, disproportionately becoming victims, with about 80 health workers killed so far.
Yep. Yeah, the doctors and nurses that are on the front lines putting their lives on the line and are literally putting their lives on the line. I spoke to the president today, and she mentioned that they've lost a lot of doctors and nurses, and their biggest need at the moment is actually not money as much as it is medical personnel. They just don't have them there, and that's their biggest need, is to get people who are willing to come in and help out, but of course at great personal risk. Unfortunately, the hospitals are a very risky place to go, and so the rest of the health system is also collapsing because people with other diseases, malaria, or tuberculosis, or HIV, or just broken bones, or that need common surgeries, are staying away from the hospitals, and so other health issues are also rising at the same time.
Well, if people answer the call from the developed world to come to Liberia, clearly, not only should they be bringing their own medical expertise, they should also be bringing all the equipment and all of
right.
the prophylactic suits and stuff like that.
That's beginning to come in. That's right. And that's beginning to come in. Finally, the international community, the World Health Organization, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control here in the United States, along with USAID, the World Bank, are now putting money up that can pay for that protective equipment. So the view now is that they will have enough protective equipment, but what they really need is the doctors and the nurses that are willing to take on this risk. But it is a huge risk, and it's very difficult to find the people to do that. But that's their greatest need at the moment. It's going to take a very large international effort to stop this thing and to keep it from spreading further.
Well, Steve Radelet, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Radelet, who's the Donald F. McHenry Chair of Global Human Development and a professor of the Practice of Development at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Formerly, he was a senior advisor to Secretary of State Clinton and chief economist of USAID. He focuses on economic growth, poverty reduction, and foreign aid, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, and has served as economic advisor to Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf since 2005. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the exaggerated fear of the Islamic State. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and the author of Sacred Space and Holy Wars, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. He has an article at the History News Network, Americans are worried about ISIS and Putin. What they should be worried about is climate change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks, Ian.
And there's no question that the Islamic State has captured the attention of the world, and particularly the President of the United States. He's going to be doing an address on Wednesday. about a strategy to deal with 10,000 marauding Mad Max type fighters in the middle of Syria and Iraq. And as you've pointed out in your article at the History News Network, implying somehow that we are perhaps exaggerating their importance, they dominated the NATO summit along with what's happening in Ukraine. Yet there's only 10,000 of these guys. So in the overall scheme of things, you can't help feeling that ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State is punching way above its weight.
Well, they certainly like publicity, and they managed to get a lot of it. It is also true that they put together a political coalition with the notables of cities like Mosul and Raqqa, and they're playing a political role now and not just the role of a small terrorist group. The situation in Syria and Iraq reminds me a little bit of that in Southeast Asia in the 70s, where you had the rise of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, and very large numbers of people ended up dead, a lot of trouble. And there were people at that time who wanted the U.S. to, under Gerald Ford or Jimmy Carter, to get back involved in Southeast Asia, and they resisted that impulse. Mr. Obama seems not very successful in resisting the impulse in the case of the Middle East.
But is that to say, then, that we at first underestimated the Khmer Rouge as an obscure, originally was referred to as a Maoist guerrilla group, and yet they managed to murder about a third of the population of Cambodia in perhaps the most recent genocidal horror, at least one that approaches the scale of the Nazi Holocaust. And is that to say, then, that the Islamic State could be underestimated and could end up being a greater threat than it is now?
Well, it's certainly extremely murderous, and were it to extend its political power over the Alawites in western Syria, and it's already, you know, displaced hundreds of thousands of various kinds of Shiites and other heterodox groups. It certainly could rack up a large casualty count. My point really is not that it's unimportant, so much as that there are other things that are more important, which are getting no particular traction in Washington, D.C., and which affect the lives of everyday Americans in a much more thoroughgoing way. And there's something odd about American political culture that I think really goes back to our days as a frontier nation, that there's kind of New York and the areas that that the elite controls, and then there's that frontier out there where there are the natives are restless and it's dangerous, and you have to have cavalry forts. And in a way, the Middle East has become that kind of frontier. In the United States, people aren't happy unless there's a sense that we're in control of it. And of course, we can't be in control of it.
But why then do you think it seems to be touching a nerve in terms of conversation, people's concerns? As I mentioned, the president's going to be addressing the nation about it on Wednesday. It dominated the NATO summit. There's something about ISIS that clearly it contributes to the exaggerated threat that it poses.
Well, as long as it was only in operating in a big way in Syria, it seems not to have attracted that much attention in Washington, D.C. I think the fall of the Sunni Arab areas of Iraq to it probably are what kicked off the current round of hand-wringing. And I think in part, that might be because for this organization to control 40% of the Iraqi land area is a powerful challenge to the entire narrative of the conservative narrative of the Iraq War, that the U.S. invaded and established some form of democracy, and it may have left behind a somewhat fragile state, but still it was better than in Saddam Hussein's time. And none of those things is true if ISIL is in charge of the Sunni Arab areas of Iraq.
But again, there's only 10,000 of them, and what, there's 20 million Iraqi Sunnis, is that right?
My guess is that the Iraqi Sunnis are something like 17% of the population, which is 32 million.
Uh-huh.
So it wouldn't be nearly that many. It would be something like 5 million people.
Uh-huh. But even 5 million as opposed to 10,000 is a pretty extraordinary ratio. You get the feeling that, I mean, my understanding, I spoke yesterday with the former CIA officer, Robert Baer, who's in touch with the tribal leaders trying to get them visas to come to the U.S. They're not necessarily being counted in the calculus, as far as I know, and they certainly have been alienated by Maliki's government. But if anybody could take care of the Islamic State, it would be the Sunni Arab tribes, who appear to be in a somewhat temporary alliance of convenience with them, as opposed to being conquered by them.
About a third of the Sunni Arabs in northern Iraq identify themselves, as having tribe, of having a strong sense of their kinship politics. But in my view, what's really happened here is that the urban notables of big cities like Mosul is like the size of Houston, it's a couple million people, have thrown in with the so-called Islamic State, because they were just completely done out with the way that al-Maliki was treating them. They weren't getting government services. They were being treated as second-class citizens. The Shiites were lording it over them. The army was increasingly a Shiite in coloration. And it's convincing them that they made a mistake that's going to change the situation. The tribal forces are relatively minor, in my view, and they represent themselves as more important than they actually are.
So again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. And his latest book just out is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. And he has an article at the History News Network, Americans Are Worried About ISIS and Putin. What they should be worried about is climate change. So the fact that the Iraqi lawmakers approved a cabinet and a new prime minister today, does that mean anything, Juan?
Well, it's a good sign, and the Obama administration, I heard John Kerry speak about this, sees it as a big turning point. It is a more inclusive government. It has some Sunni ministers, but let's face it, the defense and interior ministries were not announced. The heads of those ministries were not announced. Sunni Arabs are not going to be reincorporated into this government very easily. I think probably they have to be given one or the other of those posts, and the Shiites are very reluctant. The interior ministry in Iraq, is kind of like our FBI. It has to do with internal crime and security. At some point, a decade ago, the Sunnis were in charge of the Ministry of Defense, or there was a Sunni minister. But unless this government can, I think, make a stronger case for the inclusion of the Sunni Arabs than was announced today, it's going to have a very hard road ahead.
So if the tribal leaders are exaggerating their influence, and if the second biggest city in Iraq has thrown its lot in with the Islamic State, again, is that a permanent alliance in your mind? I mean, if the Sunnis are so angry, which they have every right to be because of their treatment by al-Maliki, their marginalization, they didn't get their oil revenue. They didn't get the rights that they expected. And my understanding is that they would like to go the way of the Kurds. I thought that what was holding up the process, in effect, is that the U.S. still wants to believe that they're dealing with a unitary state, as do the Iranians. And maybe they're both whistling past the graveyard.
I think that the Sunni Arabs of Iraq are ambivalent. They had, for decades, been the centerpiece of Iraqi and Arab nationalism and the least likely people to argue for any kind of breakup or secession. But the al-Maliki reign since 2006 has driven them, some of them, into that position of wanting a separate government or some kind of greater autonomy from Baghdad. And of course, at the moment, they have more or less seceded. In fact, they're more separate from Baghdad than the Kurds are. These things, however, are fluid. You know, winning them back over is the charge that Washington and Europe have given to the government of Haider al-Abadi, the new prime minister. And it's a hard task, but it's not a completely impossible one. That is to say, I don't think that that the breakup of Iraq is a foregone conclusion. It's highly likely, but there is this one last chance to try to bring it back in.
And in terms of the president's coalition, I noticed that the supreme leader in Iran said that he gave permission, if you will, for the Iranian military to work with the Americans. But conversely, you don't hear much from Saudi Arabia, which has a tremendous amount of military hardware that they bought from the United States, all the latest fighters and et cetera. They don't seem to be doing anything, and they seem unlikely to be involved in taking on their fellow Sunnis. And my understanding is that the Saudis can't even rely on their own army to police that border between Syria and Iraq, that they've hired Egyptian and Pakistani mercenaries. So there have been some articles recently by a former MI6 official suggesting that the real agenda of the Islamic State is to take over the Hejaz and free the holy shrines of Mecca and Medina from the al-Sauds and create the very caliphate that they proclaimed. Do you give that much credibility?
Well, I should think that if the so-called Islamic State has designs on Saudi Arabia, sure, a symbolic victory around Mecca and Medina would certainly boost their prestige, but they surely have their eye, more importantly, on the oil in the eastern province. I don't think that it's very likely that they can make much inroad into Saudi Arabia, which does have a state. And, you know, so far, they've only really succeeded in places where the state collapsed, in eastern Syria and northern and western Iraq, and where they were able to make coalitions with local aggrieved Sunni Arabs who were completely disgruntled with their government. In both cases, in Syria and Iraq, you have a minority-led government, or a Shiite-led government, I meant to say. In Syria, a minority-led government. In Iraq, the Shiites are a majority, but they were ruling as a kind of tyranny of the majority. I don't anticipate that this organization could have very much success in a place with a real state in Jordan or in Saudi Arabia. Of course, they can blow things up, and blowing some things up in Saudi Arabia would have potentially a big impact on the world. The Saudis are now building a wall between them and Iraq, so they're taking the right wing American approach to their borders.
And the that's an awful long. It's almost as chimeric as sealing off the border with Mexico. There's thousands of miles of desert we're talking about now, or at least in Saudi case, hundreds of miles.
Yes, it's not very realistic.
So just then, in closing, Juan Cole, back to your article at the History News Network, Americans are worried about ISIS and Putin. What they should be worried about is climate change. Is it because, for example, that the Islamic State and the exaggerated and fevered kind of coverage about these people who behead people and are beyond the pale and, you know, are medieval in many ways, this just excites the imagination of what you're arguing here is that we're distracting ourselves from the biggest threat that we face. And furthermore, the biggest threat that we face, which is climate change, is something that, one, we can do something about, and two, we as Americans are largely responsible for.
Yes, so the Americans put out 5 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide every year, about 5 billion metric tons, and it's about 16 tons per person. This is per capita much more than any other advanced industrial society. And we're not making very much progress in drastically reducing it. It needs to be drastically reduced if we're to avoid severe climate consequences, which will have a big effect on the everyday lives of a lot of Americans. So you can already see in the Gulf of Mexico coastal areas, there's salinization from rising seas, the prospect for long-term drought in the Southwest is enhanced in the projections that have been done on climate change. So this is going to badly affect millions of Americans, whereas ISIL, as horrible as it is, and as big a problem it is for as it is for Syria and Iraq, you know, it's very unlikely to ever really affect the lives of most Americans. And you know, there are other similarly horrible organizations out there. There's killing going on in the Central African Republic and in the Congo, and you know, for some reason, the American political imaginary has fixed upon the Middle East as a realm in which they must attempt to establish order in order to feel good about themselves. And the real tragedy is, of course, that the more imperial intervention you have in the Middle East, the less order there is.
And so just in closing, is there anything the president can say on Wednesday that is going to add anything to what's this overheated fear of this group and this extraordinary focus on it by the United States?
Well, I think President Obama wants to calm down the hysteria, and he's doing so with a strategy that's largely based on air intervention in support of local military forces. In Iraq's case, the Iraqi army, but willy-nilly, Iraqi Shiite militias, which are fighting alongside the army, and even Iranian Revolutionary Guards, and then the Kurdish Peshmerga. And one of the big problems that the president has, and I know he knows it, is that giving close air support to Shiite militias and the Iraqi army, which is largely Shiite, and to the Kurdish Peshmerga, to take Sunni Arab-held territory is a very bad optic. It doesn't look good, and is going to get the Sunni Arabs back up. And that's the function of trying to deploy the Sunni tribal forces and so forth. But I'm very skeptical that Obama will be able to turn any very substantial number of Sunni Arabs to join this ragtag coalition he's trying to put together on the ground.
Unless they can promise them something. They don't believe that the Shia government will ever help them, so they really want to go the way of the Kurds, don't they? They want...
Well, there are a lot that just are done out with the government, Shia government in Baghdad, and remember that under General Petraeus, there was a Sunni Arab movement against the religious radicals called the Awakening Councils or the Sons of Iraq. Mm-hmm. Some 100,000 fighters joined up, And as the Americans were winding things down, those 100,000 people were largely left twisting in the wind. They had a big target on their backs because they had opposed al-Qaeda. Some were assassinated. Only 17,000 were ever hired by the Iraqi state. Most of them ended up unemployed. And then the Maliki government actually prosecuted some of them for crimes committed before they joined the Awakening Councils, alienating them. So, you know, this is a kind of story that Charlie Brown is always kicking at the football that Lucy pulls away from him at the last moment and ending on his back. And the Sunni Arabs of Iraq, you know, in order to play this game again and create new Awakening Councils against the so-called Islamic State, they'd have to be really reassured that what Maliki did to them wouldn't be repeated, and I don't think they are assured.
Well, Juan Cole, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com, and he's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest book just out is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. He also has an article at the History News Network, Americans Are Worried About ISIS and Putin. What they should be worried about is climate change. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we're back joined in the studio by my colleague Antonio Gonzalez.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account?
¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is Antonio Gonzalez, who's the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, founded in 1974. It's the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the United States, and he and SVREP have been central figures in the dramatic growth of Latino political participation across the nation. During Gonzalez's tenure at the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, it has nearly tripled Latino registration from 5.5 million in 1994 to more than 14 million registrants in 2012. He hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Sessions, Mondays at 4 p.m., and Time magazine named Gonzalez as one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Antonio Gonzalez.
Hi, Ian. It's a pleasure being with you here.
But not necessarily under the best circumstances, given the furor and the sense of disillusionment that I detect in the Latino community as a result of the president reneging on his promise to invoke executive action on to solve the or at least to address immigration reform in deference to his belief that at least the senators probably weighed in on him, saying that we're facing difficult re-elections and this is not going to help us. So tell me what's happening on Spanish-speaking media. Is this my understanding is that there's a storm out there?
I think that's an understatement. In the Spanish TV, Univision is I think leading the charge. Very upset, and in Spanish radio, you have it. I was just on Univision Radio right now, getting callers in left and right. There's a lot of. There was great anticipation of the president's executive order, which was said to potentially benefit 5 to 6 million undocumented persons. It never happened, so we don't know exactly what was going to be in it. But, you know, the administration has broken now by, our count, either five or six promises on immigration reform. But I got to tell you, this one was the most plausible to believe of all of the others. All the others required legislative action, and you could see problems in the legislative action. From his promise to the first 30 days doing a reform, first 100 days doing a reform, first year, first 2 years before 2012, all those things where, you know, he had to get a bill to sign. He didn't lead on those things, and he didn't help when we needed help. But this one was entirely within his power, so it seemed the most plausible. He made a commitment 6 months ago to do a study. The study was coming back. He said the study's coming back good. He says, you were right, to the immigrant rights lobby. You said I had the power. I said I didn't. I was wrong. You were right. All these things he said, and then he pulled the rug. Basically, a couple of weeks after embattled Democratic senatorial candidates appealed to him, and we're speaking most specifically of direct appeals from the Arkansas, Louisiana, and North Carolina Democratic incumbents Kay Hagan, Mark Pryor, and Mary Landrieu, and then also with a Me Too from, unfortunately, somebody who I like. But he did it. Al Franken from Minnesota said Me Too as well, calling for the president to delay action. And the president succumbed to that. He says he didn't, but he did. And in the community, there is tremendous anger and tremendous disillusionment.
But let's try and figure out the thinking here, because I don't understand, Antonio, why the president would alienate the fastest growing constituency in the country. In midterm elections, traditionally, the Democrats' problem is that they don't get enough people to show up. And why is that? Because they don't inspire people to show up. So you're disillusioning a whole bunch of people in order to accommodate centrist senators who are worried. What are they worried about? Are they worried about the idea that the Republicans are going to call this amnesty, and they're going to be all riled up and come out to vote? Or are they, I mean, why don't they take on these canards like amnesty? Why don't they take a stand on this issue rather than run away from it, which is what they're doing, because they're basically saying, this is just going to cause us problems. It's only causing them problems because they're not standing up and shooting down the nonsense that the Republicans are throwing at them.
Well, I have no ability to peer into the president's mind. I don't know why he made this decision. I can tell you that I do think it is reflective of the way sort of the two-party political establishment has evolved and how they do their politics. By these rules of engagement, there would have been no 1964 Civil Rights Act. LBJ would have never been able to get the kind of checkoff from public opinion and senators and political calculations about re-election and so forth. He never would have gotten it. In fact, when he signed the 64 Civil Rights Act, he said, this is going to hurt the Democratic Party for 30 years. He was correct, but it was still the right thing to do as a matter of policy and as a matter of morality and as a matter of democracy. This president doesn't seem to have those chops. And I say this with all respect, even though his actions are very disrespectful to the community. And you're correct. It is a demobilizing. If I was a Democratic operative, which I'm not, I would be really upset, because you've just pulled out a linchpin from the most, not the most important constituency, but the newest important constituency in the Democratic lexicon, which is the growing Latino community, 14 million voters, about 8 million of whom can be expected to vote reliably in this cycle. But that number will go down now. If the president had acted, it could have gone up to 9 million. Now, the pundits will say, well, they're in the wrong states. By and large, that's true. Latino political leverage is most important in Colorado in this cycle. And interestingly, the Senate candidate there, incumbent Mark Udall, did not ask the administration to delay. In fact, he was campaigning on immigration reform. So, it hurt him. where in Louisiana and Arkansas, small Latino vote. But in North Carolina, you have about 150,000 Latino voters, and that's not insignificant. So I think the Democratic senatorial candidates and the president are guilty of, playing a play it safe calculus. By the way, they did the same thing in 2010. Look how that came out, right? In 2010, there was a summer deal between the immigrant rights and the legislative leadership to do a partial immigration reform bill, and because we couldn't get the whole thing through, there was too many squirrely Democrats, but do a partial legalization, get that in hand, and go forward. And at the end of the day, they decided not to because they said, "Well, we're going to lose the speakership, we're going to lose Nancy Pelosi," and we told them at that point straight. Eye to eye, Nancy Pelosi politically is dead woman walking. You're going to lose the House anyway. Do this while you have the power. And it's deja vu all over again. The same scenario. They're going to lose the Senate. And now they're going to lose the Latino vote at some level along the way in losing the Senate.
So rather than inspire their voters to come out, they're afraid that they're going to somehow rile up the voters against them who are already riled up in any case.
That's right.
That's pretty bizarre logic.
Well, you know, the political consultants are creatures of habit. And what the first rule of politics is don't get anybody mad at you. Don't get any group really mad at you. But they're already mad. Mm-hmm. And, he made the decision that he made. And now really it's up to advocates and leaders across the Latino and immigrant rights communities to decide what the response is going to be. There are some that want to roll over. And I think former Mayor Henry Cisneros and some others have already said, well, he's right. Let's have him have a way. We'll just be patient and roll over. And then there's others that are thinking of ways to hold the administration and the Democrats accountable.
But if the Republicans take the Senate, forget about immigration reform. It's all over. I mean, isn't that obvious?
I think there's no immigration reform. There's no legislation. No matter who's in control of the Senate.
I see.
It's just too easy to block.
Because the House have already, forget the House.
Forget the House. The House is going to gain Republican seats. It's already an anti-immigrant preponderance. You can't change that until probably consecutive elections in 16 and 18. And in the best case scenario, the Senate is always conservative because one person can block in the Senate. You need 60 votes to get important legislation through. Yeah. So we're really not looking at a legislative victory if the Democrats hold the Senate, which is not going to happen. But if it did, we're not looking at a big or a good immigration bill there. Yeah. The hope is to get executive action by the administration. And frankly, people are now saying, forget Washington. Let's get stuff in states. And in California, there's been a clear demonstration that that's a possibility with several pro-immigrant pieces of state legislation. The executive order is the only national game with a realistic chance.
Again, I'm speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, who's the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, founded in 1974. It's the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., and he and SVREP have been central figures in the dramatic growth of Latino political participation across the nation during Gonzalez's tenure. 10-year Southwest Voter Registration Education Project has nearly tripled Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million registrants in 2012. And Antonio hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Sessions, Mondays at 4 p.m. And Time magazine named Gonzalez as one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America. So did this surge in unaccompanied minors flooding across the southern border change the debate and change the calculus on the part of the president and affect these vulnerable senators who've obviously persuaded him to delay executive action on immigration reform? In the President Obama's interview on Meet the Press on Sunday, he said, as you know, the truth of the matter is that the politics did shift midsummer because of the problem on the border.
The answer to that is two-part. Yes, and so what? You don't craft national public policy based on the ebb and flow of opinion polls. There's always going to be some kind of occurrence, whether it's war in the Middle East or some flare-up on the border, that will always happen. In the main, the public is favorable to fixing the immigration system. The unfortunate circumstances with the Central American unaccompanied minors is now receding as measures are taken in Mexico and on the border. And the administration, I mean, frankly, the president, it took a cheap shot by blaming these children for his problems. He claims to be cerebral and above this, but this is some of the worst of political calculation that I've seen. Yeah, there was a hickey in the opinion polls. Americans didn't like it. I get that. It underscores the need for reform, though.
But didn't one of the reasons why Americans perhaps didn't like what was happening on the southern border was that they were being given a distorted picture by Fox News and by a lot of the mainstream press. And when you've got governors like Perry down in Texas talking about sending the National Guard down and further militarizing an already militarized border, when these kids are literally looking for somebody to surrender to, they're not sneaking across the border. They're surrendering to the Border Patrol. If you told the real picture, it's a completely different one.
The real picture is that the kids and their parents, the fact that they were captured proves that the border is more secure. They weren't running away from the Border Patrol. They were running to the Border Patrol. And there's 18,000 Border Patrol now on the U.S.-Mexico border. It's more than ever in American history. It's not that easy to get through anymore. And so they were, it is proof that the draconian measures along our border are working to apprehend, 6-year-olds and maids or wannabe maids. So that's true. It's true. It was distorted. The media, corporate media, tends to always distort and sensationalize these things. But the president knows better.
So, well, and I thank you very much for joining us here today in the studio.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, who's the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, founded in 1974. It's the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the United States, and he and SVREP have been central figures in the dramatic growth of Latino political participation across the nation. And during Gonzalez's tenure at the Southwest Voter and Education Project, it has nearly tripled Latino registration from 5.5 million in 1994 to more than 14 million registrants in 2012. And Antonio hosts his own weekly radio program here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Session, Mondays at 4 p.m. And Time Magazine named Gonzalez as one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.